perhaps we can get together and start. We have a full and interesting session.
And that's what it does.
I was going to do introductions, but it's a little late. Let me try to do maybe just two words on every person. We have Clotilde Fonseca, who's the founding director of the Costa Rican Program on Educational Informatics, and the executive director of the Omar Dengo Foundation there. We have Ineke Buskins, who's an international gender research and facilitation consultant and leads GRACE, the Gender Research into Information and Communications Technology for Empowerment. We have Ethan Zuckerman, a Berkman Fellow and serial social entrepreneur, founder of Geekworks and of Global Voices and a variety of other things. We don't have Mike Best, who is going to speak tomorrow. Instead, we have Sabri Saidam, who is currently an advisor to the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and former Minister of Telecommunications and IT in Palestine. And we have Nancy Spence, this is the problem with Spence around this table. Too many searches. Director of Economic and Social Development Affiliates. We're going to change slightly the organization in the sense that Clotilde, if you'll open us, but we'll move to Sabri Saidam second because he has to go to the airport and before the end of this session, and then we'll move from there, if that's okay with you. And I will try to follow the same model of really, let's do 10 minutes as 10 minutes.
Okay. As we had said before, we went off to lunch. This is an extremely complex topic and a very rich topic that we need to consider from many different dimensions. But I would like to start by giving you an example of something that happened in Costa Rica a year ago. We have a program called Avancemos, called Getting Ahead, and it's a program that provides small grants to young children and youth so that they can stay in school. And many of these adolescents who got these grants run off and went to buy cell phones, mobiles. And there was a whole discussion in the country as to whether this was good or bad, a little bit along the lines of the discussions that were held earlier. And many people, adults, analyzing this situation, thought these kids are going to use these telephones. But actually, what the kids said is, this is wonderful because now we have a watch, a calculator, a communication device, a messaging instrument, an exchange, and a community building resource. They were not so interested in the telephone that most adults were interested in. They were interested in texting and in other aspects. So the discussion that came about really had to do with vision and how do you conceive this phenomena of changes in technology and the potential of this technology. I have to confess I come to this topic with a great amount of excitement about these technologies. But at the same time, I come to the table with a concern for the lack of understanding of these technologies. Very frequently, we see new technologies and describe them as ICTs, and therefore put an emphasis on information and communication, which are generally terms that people are used to. So very frequently we go through what McLuhan would say, looking at the future through the rearview mirror. And I find that particularly in the developing world, there is a reductionist view of what these technologies can be about. And very frequently projects that are developed, and even after WISIS, which I think was a marking point of discussions worldwide, we see that many of the projects are extremely technocentric. They're highly centered on the internet, getting access to the internet, and nobody can deny the fascination and the power of the internet that I think we're barely starting to understand. But certainly digital technologies, I prefer to call them digital because I think we have a digital revolution going on, and we have to try to understand what that is about. These digital technologies have much more power and much more possibility than just downloading and uploading into the internet. They have to do with interactivity, they have to do with productivity, they have to do with multimedia, they have to do with an array of different aspects that are really changing the way we go about doing things in contemporary life. And I think that that vision needs to be well understood, especially by leaders and decision makers. Why? Basically because technical decisions are basically political decisions because they imply the definition of priorities. So when we are going to prioritize how we're going to go about investing, we'd better have a vision of where we're going. If our vision is very short term and we just see the gadget, the last gadget or the last technology available, we're not going to see how we need to move our people in providing them with opportunities to develop their capacities to interact with technology in a concept closer to what we can call technology fluency, meaning this capacity to deal with technology and adapt to new technology, to use it, to appropriate it, to do creative things around it, but also in terms of the ways we set up projects to bridge the gap. And I think that the gap is much more than what we call the digital gap. I've always been amazed at the fact that we talk about ICTs, but we talk about digital gap. We talk about knowledge society and we talk about information society, but we talk about digital gap. And I think that what is really important in terms of our focus is how we understand that in order to bridge the digital gap, in whichever way we understand it, it may be talking about mobiles or talking about computers or talking about networks, we also have to close the cognitive divide, the cognitive gap, the gap of intellectual capacity to be able to profit from these technologies. And we're not really going to get far in terms of poverty reduction unless we are able to use these technologies to stimulate those symbolic capacities, those intellectual capacities, those creative capacities. Many of you know Carr and his discussions about digital technologies being infrastructural technologies that have changed the way we go about things, so, you know, in very general terms. And I think that one of the great things that he's said is that these technologies are a condition to be able to function in the modern world. But having them is not necessary, not sufficient. As in the case of electricity, nobody could think about the modern world without electricity. But that's certainly not enough. What is really fundamental is being able to add value, being able to work with these technologies in creative and innovative ways. And the great challenge is how countries, communities, groups, schools, homes are able to provide new generations with experiences, learning experiences, with forms of access that can actually elicit the development of these capacities that are the new capacities that we require. And that is certainly a major challenge. It is easier to say than to go about it. And the reason why I mention this is because it has to do with leadership and the need to have modern leaders, political leaders, who can understand these revolutions, not just as the deployment of infrastructure plus content, and think that that is the solution, but to understand that what is really needed is to have a new set of skills and competencies, particularly in young people, where I think we need to focus very strongly our investments. If you look at the post-WISIS discussions, and particularly those of us who have been involved at the, for in my case, at the Latin American level, looking at post-WISIS plans, it is amazing how limited and technocentric they still are after such a huge investment, preparatory investment, and the investment in the conference itself. Most of these projects are technocentric. They're devoted, they're separated from capacity building efforts. They're not integrated in countries in policies that bring people from the education community with people from the science and technology community with people from the telecom community. So this is really a major challenge. Do I have any minute?
One minute.
Okay. So I would like to, I think that the main thing, the rest is in the paper you've read. I think that the main element here is being able to distinguish between the analog and the digital, and to position development efforts in the digital, not in analog visions of development. I would also like to stress the fact that we now have problems with indicators of advancement in terms of knowledge society, in terms of technology resources, and very limited research tools to actually capture those things that are qualitative, that are really transformative, that really have an impact. And we have tools and indicators that actually limit the possibilities to show those things that are really fundamental. I would stop here. I would just like to mention that there was a great interest some years back in social networks and funding to study social networks. I've seen in recent years that there has been a limited investment in networks. And from what I remember from the Harvard Forum 1, we were sharing this, there was Jim Moore who was invited and introduced us to blogging, and he took us over to the Berkman Center to see blogging happen. This was just 6 years ago, and look at the dimension of what that tiny little development meant in terms of citizenship participation and global interactions. And we are in the midst of a new phenomena that I think it was Teilhard de Chardin who referred to it as the noosphere, which is certainly the social or the civic layer of the internet and the knowledge layer of the internet. I think that is in the making, but unless we develop the capacities of people in developing countries to interact with this knowledge, to have access, not only contact, to this knowledge, we're not going to get ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to use the time, split it in half. The first half, I would like to talk about this microphone. Why is it working? Yeah, second half.
There we go.
Got a free assistant here. Okay, I would like to split my time into two halves. One half is to talk about what matters most in terms of developing countries or the so-called southern states. And the other half, I would like to show you part of the results of the work with IDRC, recent work in the MENA region. So to draw your attention to areas that I think deserve to receive more and more attention and emphasis from our side. Now, I would like to play the naive role of being so simple in putting my words rather than being so sophisticated, philosophical, or academic. Sometimes I feel we need to ask the man and the woman in the street as to how they feel about ICT. And from my observation, there's little things that are big in value, but sometimes we go past without realizing them. One of which is the lack of leadership. And I know this issue was mentioned earlier, but I really want to emphasize this. And I've studied several countries, ranging from Costa Rica, President Ramos' time, to Senegal, to Sheikh Maktoum in Dubai. And I've seen how the leader can play a pivotal role in pulling the whole society towards ICT, or forgetting about the whole notion of ICT adoption. And I say in southern states, there's lack of leadership in terms of ICT diffusion and dissemination. On the other hand, I noticed that society is very far away from awareness of the importance of ICT. In fact, I say in my paper that if ICT is challenged against religious and social values, sometimes it doesn't stand. And I here wish to touch on a sensitive issue that we often forget about, is that senior citizens have not really been included in the information age. This computer remains to be this elusive box towards which they have this phobia, and they never get to interact that much. And if we look at the family as a unit of society, we'll have to focus on to bringing in the senior citizens. And I often say that I was not born knowing how to use the computers. I learned my way through. And maybe in 20 years' time, my son will be laughing at me the same way he laughs at his grandmother. And the cycle continues. So we will have to address awareness and senior citizen inclusion. The third issue, which is really biting the heart of every man and woman in my society, is the allegiance to donor community. Sometimes you have donors who would want to project an image of, you know, specific image that they direct your project according to their needs. And we often find ourselves working in villages without knowing that the villages next door have the same project. And we get to duplicate because there's competition. There's also the political motivation behind the concessions. And in a conflict-torn community such as mine, the more you give in, the more money you get. Sadly, that's the rule of the game. Does not apply to every country, but it applies to some countries around the world. Fourth is the absence of the legal environment. I have pushed hard to liberalize the telecom market. I have not left office until I released the tender for a new mobile operator. I have been threatened with assassination so many times. It's only because I was personally, and I'm sure this applies to everyone, but I talk about myself. So to just give you a prime example as to how money really matters. And some people have said to me that the cost of getting rid of you is only a dollar or two, but you're affecting our millions of dollars. But we really have to push this market liberalization, but at the same time, getting the laws to support this e-environment as such. I fought hard for market liberalization as well as the regulation and instating regulator law. But at the same time, I often feel guilty that there's 21 laws awaiting to be ratified, the internet law, the intellectual property rights law, you know, and what have you. So many laws to pass, and now e-learning, e-health, you know, the list, I would say, stretches endlessly. Fifth is the weakness of the educational system. And I will show you in my demo one thing that I came across, but I have to admit that I came across quite late this link between education and ICT, and the importance of adopting the open source culture, which I support myself. If you look at my country's school curriculum, Microsoft is everywhere. I have nothing against Microsoft. I have nothing against Bill Gates, your friend. I just say that people have to have access to technology, and internet should be free for all. The sixth issue, which is the lack of market competitiveness, and here I talk about specifically about the telecom market, that competition is sometimes appears to be fierce, but to get to liberate the market takes a bit of guts, and competitiveness is not there because in the third world, often corruption is associated with telecom industry, and this impedes the reduction of prices so people can get to interact more with the internet. I'll just jump to the computer over there. That's the second half of it. Just to show you, this is, as I said, the result of the work with IDRC, quite recent work in 10 countries in the MENA region. I have not released this. I would have to seek the permission of IDRC to release it. But let's go back. So the idea is basically was to think out of the box as to how the MENA region should appear to be in the coming from years 2011 to 2015. Okay, and here you have 10 Arab countries. I would just like to show you the difference between Yemen, for example, and so leave the computer works. It didn't strike me at all during the time of data collection. It didn't get to me until I put the data together and I produced this flash file, that literacy rate in Yemen is only 50%. If you look at a country like Lebanon, for example, if you look at the education literacy rate is 87.4. I did notice that, which is something that's very simple, is that the better the education system, the more accessibility you have and the more connectivity you have. And this is clear. I want to take you back to Yemen, for example, and just show you how telecommunications is. I'll make this available with the permission of IDRC. But if you look, mobile, the blue line is the mobile ownership, but the rest is internet and other forms of communications. It's not flying. No? It's not flying at all. Now, if we go to Kuwait, let's go to Lebanon, and we look at telecommunication. I'm sorry, it takes a bit of time. Doing much better, huh? You will need time to go through this, but as I said, we'll make it available. But just wanted to show how the educational system, the literacy level, even more goes into this when you have time to go through it, to see how small components of awareness, of education, of literacy, of leadership really play a role in the life story. I'm done. How about that?
Thank you. You're ahead of time. Okay. That's great. Thank you.
What matters most, in my opinion, is for human beings to live a life on this planet that is worthy of human aspiration and to co-create as humanity a world that is conducive to conscious human evolution. I'm not only thinking here of the people for whom we are gathered here, the people who have come to be known as the poor, the bottom of the pyramid, I'm also thinking of us and people like us. There's no bottom without a top, and the top is just as much part of the problem as the bottom, because we define each other, and what is more, we are all connected. Separation really is an illusion. The reality which we are all waking up to in these days of global warming and financial decline is that we are all connected. So what should this matter for us most here, the people who have this beautiful opportunity to come together and reflect in this beautiful space, is to, on questions of human development, poverty reduction, growth, and the use of information communication technology, is to work with and within concepts that are aligned to this dream. And over lunch, I was sitting at a table and we were reminiscing what Gandhi had said, and that was, become the change you want the world to be. So this is also a call to be coherent in our concepts, because concepts are very, very powerful. I do not have to speak to you about how powerful concepts are, but I was struck again. Last week I was in Darwin, and of course it being the Darwin year, I did a Darwin tour with a very, very knowledgeable Darwin expert, and he told me the following story, that the biggest problem the church of his days had with Darwin's concept of evolution didn't have to do with time. It didn't have to do with the 7 days of creation, because the church of those days was actually very open to the idea of deep time, and they took the 7 days very symbolical. Their problem was with the concept of redemption, because if there was evolution, there may not have been a fall. And if there was no fall, there would not have been a need for redemption. So if there would be no need for redemption, what would the cornerstone of the power and the position of the church be, right? And I don't have to remind you that women's pilgrimage towards dignity and gender equality in the West would have been fundamentally different if the churches, all the religions of the book, I might say, all the three religions of the book, wouldn't have been so married to the concept of the fall. Because in all those religions of the book, women are made responsible for the fall. So this is just an introduction. I'm now going back to our focus on human development and our efforts to think our way out of poverty into wealth through the use of ICTs. And I want to highlight two insights I gained through GRACE, the IDRC-supported Gender Research in ICTs for Empowerment Research Networks in Africa and the Middle East, that I think are pertinent to our discussions. In the first place, the dominant economic global mindset paradigm, and I know I'm using very naive concepts in a very highly sophisticated economic environment, but I think because I'm talking about very high degree level concepts that influence on us on many levels of consciousness and unconsciousness, I think I might just get away with it. Okay, so the dominant economic global mindset paradigm on this planet is about separation and hierarchy. It's about divide and rule, and it's about creating competition and scarcity, even when it doesn't exist. I know, for instance, in my country, South Africa, that diamonds are being burned in Kimberley to keep the price high. That is about creating scarcity where it doesn't exist, about exploitation of people and resources, and it's not about partnership and connection, and neither is it about justice or nurturing. And I also have realized that if no other spaces are created, ICTs become the handmaidens of the system, and ICT users perpetuate these divisive characteristics. The Zambia study that took place in GRACE reveals how the use of mobile phones created a virtual class system within a group of women who used mobile phones to network with each other for the purpose of advocacy for women's rights. The cost of cell phone use created a group of callers, women who could afford the calling costs, and beepers, women who could not afford the calling costs. So the potential for connection and the intent for connection that is so much part of what we expect of mobile phones and of all ICTs, I would say, was thwarted because of the financial economic parameters in which this use still has to take place. And power differentials were created where they did not exist before. So that was the first. The second insight is that people adapt to their environment. And in doing so, they also adapt to the reflection of themselves that the environment gives them. And many people cannot imagine the dreams that would lift them out of their limitations because they do not have the building blocks for those dreams. They do not even have the concepts that match the actual experience of their lived realities. They have adapted their preferences to this power imbalanced world in order to survive in it. And it is particularly relevant to women in relationship to development and empowerment efforts. And the GRACE and Babu case study I touched on briefly in my paper showcases this dynamic. At the University of Zimbabwe in Harare, access to free library computers was governed on the basis of the rule of first come, first serve. The librarians, however, noticed that the overwhelming majority of the students using the computers were male. Asking the female students about their perspectives and experiences around access, the female students spoke about their duties as wives and mothers at home, where they had to fulfill, which they had to fulfill exactly during the time in which the computers were free, and about the fact that when they would line up for access, they would be pushed out of line by the male students. And later on, I heard that what happened in other countries was when, you know, male students and female students would have to line up together for free access to computers, much worse things actually happened between male and female students than in Zambia. So this was still mild. So, and whilst they acknowledged the first-come, first-serve rule as democratic, the female students, fair, and even some used the word empowering, they lamented at the same time that they had to put in extra efforts to get access to computers in other ways. They would have to pay at night, internet cafes, colleges, whatever. So they were holding those two concepts at the same time. The realization that it didn't have access and that it was very inconvenient and disempowering, and at the same time they held the rule as empowering. Why? Because they didn't have any other concept about that rule. That was the dominant concept about that rule. It just seems to be how the brain works. It's just a simple association, a connection. Okay. So these students did not have a concept, a way of thinking about this access rule that really matched their experience of the rule, the lived reality that was a consequence of this rule. And when the researchers subsequently deepened their research efforts and created opportunities for these women to face their experiences, emotions, reflections, and dreams, the female students were able to bring more coherence to their thinking and acknowledge their lack of access as inconvenient and disempowering. So the first-come, first-served rule was very effective in removing female competition from the computer access arena, and it also kept in place the stereotypes about women and their non-use of ICTs. And without the researchers' interventions, the female students would not have been able to do the conceptual work that would give them a position from which to question the fairness of this role. So from these two insights, it becomes obvious that there is no neutral space when it comes to knowledge, knowledge construction, and the tools that give access to knowledge at ICTs. Ours is a sexist and deeply unjust world, and I see a minefield of power dynamics everywhere. And just like a real minefield, if you're not aware and you do not take special investigative measures, you only discover the mines by stepping on them. And from this basis, I want to speak to the concept of openness that is so much at the heart of this forum. Although I do not comprehend fully all the conceptual work that has been taking place, what I do comprehend, I do appreciate, and I have my own hopes and fears in this regard, and these I want to share with you. In the first place, I think that behind the practices that are identified as acts of openness, like the development of open source software, open scientific journals, and web publishing, there are other dynamics at work. Human motivations, dreams, and aspirations, and it would be good to keep those in mind. Yesterday I heard from Matthew that Harvard University has decided to have articles published by Harvard academics immediately loaded on the Harvard website. Being the powerful institution that it is, the journals would have no choice but to comply with that. Harvard's motivation for instigating this web publishing is probably not guided by the idealism of openness, but by strategic insight into the power-knowledge dynamic. More and more immediate access to Harvard articles will enhance the author's influence in their field, it will enhance their academic reputation, and thus also Harvard's standing. A virtuous cycle indeed. Another example is open source software. When I listen to open source software designers, I do not hear them speak about their desire for openness as a value in itself. I hear the joy of connection with like minds, the joy of creating freely and releasing genius. I also hear care and concern for their environment and the desire to connect their capacities to this environment in the most useful and beneficial way. I hear a dream for a more egalitarian society where networking is the gesture from the heart and the mind, and I hear love at work. The third and last example, but I have now to be very short, is about the concept of openness as I see it working in women networks, research networks, and networks that include male and female gender researchers. They manage openness in a very, very strategic and political way. Feminists are still being killed in this world for being feminist, for standing up for women's rights. So in a world like this, there cannot be unreserved openness. And I think the more networks like this protect their boundaries against unqualified openness in the outside world, the more the openness within the networks can grow with all the beneficial aspects that come with it. So in a world of power dynamics that govern the values we attach to gender and to wealth and status and class, I think the concept of openness needs continuous and relentless questioning. Because where there is so much potential for the good, there is also the shadow side of potential great abuse. And as emergence is becoming our reality more and more, especially in the field of ICTs, and because of ICTs, we have to complement the questions of purpose, what is this openness going to be used for and for what, with the questions of intent. What is the dream you carry in your heart and mind for the openness you want to see? Einstein once said that very few people think with their own mind and feel with their own heart. I think actually in the emerging new open spaces, the new openness measures and business models in the ICT arena, there is more space for us thinking with our own minds and our own hearts. And I think actually that these emerging trends of openness are actually indicators that there is a shift taking place away from separation towards more connection. And it may be obvious, and I think that I'm trying to cut it now, one sentence. I think it's very important for us to take a stance. It's good to embrace openness, but I think for me the value would be that it is about more connection between people, and in order to safeguard that aligned with the world we want to see, we have to realize that in understanding these dynamics we also become the guardians of them, and I think we have to not take a normative stance. Because the work of connection and the work towards connection calls us to recognize power dynamics, name them, and keep them aligned with a human future that works for us all.
Thank you. Ethan?
Yes. So first of all, I'm gonna beg an extra 2 minutes because Matthew asked me to step in and talk briefly about what Global Voices is doing here. The reason that I find myself attempting to keep up with you at 80 words a minute is that we're trying very, very hard to open this larger conversation as well as the conversation tonight to a global audience. I have the good fortune to work with an international network of bloggers called Global Voices. These are people largely based in the developing world who are responsible for trying to open up conversations around the world. So essentially what's going on is we have people in a wide variety of nations who are reading people who are blogging in Tanzania, trying to summarize conversations, translating from Kiswahili into English, putting it out on the internet, and then allowing translation of all those texts under open licenses into over 30 different languages. Over the last 5 years, we've developed an audience that has a great deal of interest in the sorts of issues that we're talking about around the table. And so IDRC made a very kind offer to invite Jen Brand and myself to open up this conversation as much as possible in the hopes that we can get feedback back and forth. I think where we really see that feedback come to the fore is this evening when we're going to bring some of the questions that have been coming in from around the world into the actual seminar and put them in front of the people who are live and on stage. I will tell you that some of the subjects that have already come up in this online discussion are ideas that haven't come up around the table. The most popular question so far is a very well-constructed question about the tension between indigenous knowledge and ways to protect indigenous culture and the ability to remix and reformulate culture in a digital age. So there are some very interesting interventions that are coming into play. If you want to keep track of what's going on, I'm posting long summaries of our sessions at globalvoicesonline.org. For anyone who's on Twitter, and if you want Twitter lessons this year, for blogging lessons 6 years later, I'm happy to drag you over to the Berkman Center and try to convince you that it's interesting. People are using a hashtag, basically a declared signifier, IDRC09, to hold this conversation, and Jen is posting literally every 90 seconds little snippets of conversation. I would say, for those of us who are trying to give an insight to the rest of the world of this, it would be very, very helpful if you guys could try to be slightly less intelligent, significantly less fascinating, and if you could just repeat yourselves 3 or 4 times. So moving on from that editorial announcement to what I actually wanted to talk about. I'm very, very interested in a phenomenon that's taken place within the ICT for development community over the last 6 years or so, which has basically been our incredible embrace of the mobile phone. And our embrace of the mobile phone is evidence that even as researchers, we can occasionally see what's happening in reality. When we suddenly see in a country like Tanzania mobile phone penetration move up to 25%, it's quite obvious that something significant and real is going on that we have to take seriously. At the same time, I am not, in fact, here to praise the mobile phone, but to bury it. I want to suggest that as we have this major technological shift, there are a number of unintended consequences that we need to look very, very closely at. One of the cardinal sins at the Berkman Center, where I'm based, is technological determinism. Mm-hmm. You can shut down almost any argument by essentially saying, you are saying that this technology essentially behaves this one way or another, and we all reject that paradigm. But the reason we fall back to that is because in many cases there are technologies that are simply much better suited to certain behaviors than to others. And I think that part of what's going on is that we have embraced an ICT for development vision based around the mobile phone and haven't talked ourselves out of the notion that the mobile phone is not in fact the internet. And so I want to try to explain that by telling a story. And the story comes from Kenya in the wake of the 2007 disputed presidential elections. As I'm sure everyone here knows, there was a shutdown of mainstream media for approximately 48 hours. There was a great deal of organizing done using mobile phones. And there was a real flowering of different ways of using communication technologies for political means. We saw certain technologies take on usages that we really hadn't seen before. A lot of people who'd been involved with maintaining weblogs, and there are thousands of weblogs in Kenya, suddenly becoming highly political. People who had previously only written about technology, picking up cameras, going into the streets, and helping to close that gap of reportage that was shut down by newspapers and radio stations essentially being ordered not to report real-time news. At the same time, we had some very scary things go on, particularly around mobile phones, where mobile phones started being used to forward messages that were fomenting ethnic hatred. And we saw a fascinating tension
We're approximately 2 days after the government reappointed itself and announced that it had definitively won the elections. A message going out on networks essentially saying, please stop organizing in the streets, now would be a good time to go home, which was either a really nice way of trying to calm ethnic tensions or a really interesting way of shutting down political dissent from the Orange Democratic Movement, which had moved towards the mobile phone as its main organizational tool. Here's the trick. Certain networks are inherently generative. They're particularly good at allowing people to express themselves, at coming up with novel uses. They're extremely difficult to control who gets to introduce new possibilities on them. No one had to give these bloggers permission to suddenly turn their attentions from being focused on technology to being focused on politics. Other networks tend to have much more significant choke points and centralization. And this is one of the fundamental truths of mobile phone networks. As that mobile phone network became an extremely powerful political organizing tool, the government put pressure on the two major mobile phone operators to shut down the sending of bulk SMS, the ability to send out thousands of SMS messages at a time. That effectively shut down ODM's ability to get people out into the streets. It's very, very hard to do that sort of centralized control on an internet network. There simply aren't the centralized checkpoints where you're capable of shutting things down. But it is inherent to how mobile phone networks have currently been organized. So what's interesting is we're bringing into play technology with, I think, great and legitimate hopes for openness and repurposing for different uses, but some fundamental constraints that have to do with existing power systems. I ended up working very, very closely with a group in Kenya called Ushahidi. And Ushahidi was based around this insight that what we wanted to do was get distributed reporting of the crisis situation in Kenya. We wanted people who were in Kibera to talk about shops that had been destroyed, people who had been attacked, and get those reports in. And we knew that to build this system, we had to build the system around mobile phones. At the same time, we realized that if we really wanted it baked into the mobile phone system, in the same way that something like M-Pesa was, it could well take months. So we ended up building as an internet system bridged to the mobile phone system. And because the internet is a highly generative platform, a place where it's incredibly easy to create new functionality, the system was designed and deployed within 48 hours. But it didn't have a short code within Kenya for another 8 or 9 days. Because that was the central point of control and constraint, was the ability of mobile phone networks to essentially say, we want to review this and decide whether we want to do this or not. We're not sure that this is an application that we want to run on our network. If you think about this, this has a lot to do with the parallel evolution of phone systems versus internet systems. Phone systems throughout most of the world did not create radical new applications for the simple reason that in this country, the Bell system simply said, you can't do that. When people first introduced the voicemail, the answering machine, there were restrictions on the network, which literally said, you cannot connect this device. Part of what's been so incredible about the internet is the fact that there isn't that same sort of centralized authority. And so when someone does something deeply subversive, like inventing the ability to do telephony at extremely low cost over a PC, no one steps in and essentially says, I'm sorry, you can't deploy that application. So the caution that I want to warn us is that we have very thoroughly embraced a particular way of getting connectivity to billions of people. And I do not mean to discount the incredible impact that this connectivity has had. It's had enormous social impact. It's had enormous economic impact. It is a much better thing that it happened than that it didn't happen. But I'm going to disagree at my great risk with Dr. Spence that we can view this as an untroubling situation. I think what we have to do is realize that the technology that we've allowed to come to dominate the market has certain capabilities and certain difficulties. And as we make our plans within the ICT for development space, we need to think very seriously about how to ensure the capacities we want to have in these systems, the capacity for people to politically organize, the capacity for people to be able to report human rights violations without compromising their personal safety, the capacity for people to come up with novel applications that may have huge fiscal implications for how these systems get used. We need to figure out how to engineer these capacities within these networks. I'm going to close with one parting example that I still find myself trying to wrestle with. I was approached through Ushahidi by a scholar in Russia who was trying to figure out how to build an anti-corruption system. And he had a beautiful idea. The idea was very, very simple. After you get stopped by the police and asked for a bribe, you pull over to the side of the road, you type in a short code to your phone, and you report how much you were asked for, how much you paid, where the location was. And the idea was very rapidly we would develop a map of where people were being asked for bribes in Moscow, and this would give an opportunity to pressure authorities to crack down on certain areas. Anyone who's lived in a developing nation with a certain amount of corruption knows that you can easily start, we all build our mental maps of this to try to figure out how we navigate our way through town, but actually having a map gives the opportunity to make this a public issue and have a discussion about it. We started designing the system, and the question then became, will anyone use this? So we went on, we did a user survey, and we basically said, would you be willing to do this? And the answer was a universal no, not on your life. As soon as someone dials that short code, the feeling was the authorities would be able to triangulate your identity, your phone, and one would immediately come, take your phone, harass you, shake you down for another bribe, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the concern that we start having in these centralized systems. And it's not an illegitimate concern. In some countries, you have to assume that the mobile phone operators and the government are so close together that they function hand in glove. When Ethiopia had a disputed parliamentary election and SMS was used to organize and bring people into the streets, Ethiopia Telecom responded by shutting down short message services for 26 months. So once you're at that level of collusion between the government forces and the telecoms forces, it's very, very difficult to develop independent applications outside of this. There's lots of ways we can talk about solving it. It's beyond the time that I really have at the moment. Yochai will do bad things to me if I continue, but thank you for your attention. And in the future, please don't talk as fast as I did. Thank you very much.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Indeed.
Nancy.
Well, I'm going to talk, and maybe sum up a little bit what matters most in the so-called gender digital divide or gap, as Clotilde has mentioned. Much has changed in the past 6 years since the first Harvard Forum, and access to ICT, especially mobiles for women, is greatest where the total access is greatest, that is, highest in Asia and lowest in Africa. Examples abound, and they are generally very exciting. I won't go through those. Those are from an Asian perspective. They're in my paper. But suffice it to say that I think at last count, 250,000 Bangladeshi women were either users or mobile providers. What are some of the proven issues? Well, the debate over social use. Is social use of mobiles insufficient to justify its costs? Certainly not in the human development literature, where family and social relationships are amongst the highest contributors to well-being, with the poor spending higher shares, even up to 15 to 20% of disposable income. Ophelia had some very interesting statistics there that showed that women use the mobile, even poor women use the mobile more than wealthy women, and all of them used it more than that relative to men. So it's a base for building other roads to personal empowerment, such as community development and mobilization. I think Learn Asia and the GRACE case studies demonstrate this, though with some variation, as we've heard from Aineki, in terms of personal empowerment. The economic use, mobiles and ICTs increase opportunities and benefits for economic activities for women, including very celebrated cases in agriculture, marketing and trading, small business, time management, and more access to economic services, the whole banking and credit in particular, and access to public services, particularly health and education, which tend to matter more to women. And the third debate over the empowerment use, the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative includes security, dignity, and empowerment as potential new measurements. Taking just security, benefits of mobiles and ICT and disaster warning and management and in personal security enhancement are of major importance to women, particularly where gender-based violence is still so prevalent. Inekia certainly deepened this with examples of where ICT can actually disempower or create inequalities between women. Well, what are some of the challenges that matter? As bridge research in ICT in the early 2000s suggested, and I don't think there's been any change in this, one of the greatest challenges in harnessing ICTs for the social transformation of women is to see them as ICT producers, developers, and decision makers, not simply as consumers. And Ophelia mentioned this as being very critical in her presentation. But as both Anita and Inekia have raised, this involves a shift in power relations that reflects women's needs, interests, and aspirations much more than is currently prevalent. In fact, Bridge has said, engendering ICT is not merely about the greater use of ICTs by women, but about transforming the ICT system itself to relate more to women and their needs. So what are some of these needs? Well, there's always still the access. Many of the poorest localities still need more of a combination of market, nonprofit, self-help, and public access provision, particularly in areas of Africa. Public services is another need. Gender budget research could help identify how telehealth and distance learning could be better designed to meet women's needs, particularly in areas such as managing disaster warning and community and personal protection. Third, economic services. Development of existing and new microcredit mechanisms through SMS-based mobile banking could be transformative to women with its low costs, but needs much more greater literacy levels to perform, especially if ICT is, for example, used in English. And fourth, the social and political networking. There are a host of gender ICT activities that have been undertaken by women that promote e-literacy about their gender rights, governance, and legal reform, conflict, environment, and energy. In fact, I think it was in 1996, I was with CETA in Southeast Asia, and we funded something called Sea Watch. That was the Southeast Asian Women's Watch on, it was right after the Beijing platform, Beijing meeting. This, in the last, well, what are we, 1996, what are we now, 13 years later, this has morphed into a major internet network called APWW, the Asia Pacific Women's Watch, in which Sea Watch is part of that, which keeps track and monitors CEDAW, the Beijing Platform for Action, all the big meetings that are coming up for the Beijing Platform Plus 15 this coming year. And not only that, every time I open my computer, I've got at least four messages coming from the APWW. They've been tracking all the trade meetings, the post-Doha, et cetera, with all the issues that matter to women and really helping keep people in a kind of e-literacy about some of these issues that are very, very important to them. One of the things that it will do is that it does imply additionals. There will be extra measures that are required for the inclusiveness to ensure that the traditional inequalities that face women are being addressed. And as Sabri mentioned, you know, the extra efforts to the elderly, I think in a similar kind of way, we see this in everything that's involved in gender. Some of the areas that I have been involved in education, for example, the additionalities that are required for girls' education are separate latrines, women's, female teachers, bridge schools. In business, which is one of the areas I've been involved in, it's the incubation centers and looking at discrimination against capital and finance for women. In trade, it's just getting women to be able to understand what the WTO does and is and means to them. And certainly in HIV/AIDS as well, it's been teaching women not only the preventative aspects, but ensuring that men understand their roles in this as well. So I think in a conclusion, the gender digital divide stands a chance of being amended or at least not exacerbated further by promoting more of the equal participation of women. And I would say in summing up, The most fundamental aspect that matters is keep at it, study it, continue it, improve it, support it. It's been largely done by donors. It's been IDRC, it's been CEDA, it's been the Ford Foundation, you know, that have been supporting a lot of this. And without it, I think the alternative is essentially very counterproductive. And I'd like to be the first one to sign up for that Twitter class. Okay. Thank you.
An open system allows for learning. We don't know in advance, and so how do we define what those skills are? Are there really general purpose skills more than anything else? Sabri, to you, my question was, as I was listening to you, and in some senses this overlaps a little bit with my question to Nancy, is how much of the problem is ICTs? And how much of the problem is a given domain, be it quality of governance, be it geopolitical settings and the context of conflict? And to what extent can we really identify an intersection between ICTs and all of these other things? And to what extent do all of these other things basically become the core thing that needs to be solved, and somehow ICTs are not really part of the problem? And in that regard, the version of it, Nancy, that I had in listening to you was, how much do we have issues that are women's issues, and how much do we have things that are ICT and poverty issues? But what is the genuine intersection that's not specifically about ICT and poverty or specifically about women, but is really, what's the moment at which you say there's an ICT and women issue that's not just in the overlap with ICT and poverty on one hand, or with women's issues more generally? Ineke, to you, I guess it's, I'm not sure it's a question to you or to us out of what you are saying, but I found the story from Zambia about first come, first serve to be a very disturbing one, in the sense that what are we buying with openness? We're buying a relatively unstructured environment, and the extent to which we actually have confidence that openness will lead to destabilization of bad power structures as opposed to replacement of certain kinds of power structures with others. And so more of a question to ourselves about our happiness about openness in the context of how it might be abused, in the sense that, of course, first comes first serve is fair and open is good, but perhaps not in the particular context of power. And I think that's a big challenge to all of us. And finally, Ethan, though I sign on the dotted line for the claims, again, this is in some senses a question that I think we all need to deal with, which is, a decentralized network that is genuinely generative anywhere depends on radical decentralization of capital, that is to say, on sophisticated piece of equipment at the end. One reason that mobile phones can get off is they're much cheaper. The other is there's a carrier revenue model that allows subsidies to handsets. What is the model of funding that gets us sufficiently decentralized capitalization that allows us to actually have that level of ownership over what we do with the network that is divorced from either very expensive equipment at the ends or a carrier model to subsidize it? either answers from around the table for the people who participated or more.
I'd just like to note that.
Finds a way to come up with as vicious a question as possible and sort of knock you entirely off your feet. It's only with a true master that you get sort of five nasty, spiky questions thrown simultaneously out of the barrel. I'm going to offer a very quick technical answer while acknowledging the beauty, grace, and destructive power of that question. It's interesting. What we've seen with mobile phone operators, actually, is a decentralization of what was involved with the wireline network. So in constructing wireline networks, you needed enormous amounts of capital. You also needed the ability to essentially play within property rights to try to figure out where you're going to string a cable, whether you put it underground, so on and so forth. It required almost a governmental level of service, or at least the level of corporate organization that was capable of having huge amounts of government interaction. The mobile phone starts moving towards a slightly more decentralized activity. It's on the level of single-digit $1 million to start a network, for starters, to get the towers up, so on and so forth, and then there is the aspect of cross-subsidy. Although one of the things that we've discovered is that mobile phone networks will take off even in desperately poor countries with almost no subsidy, as we saw in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where people were willing to pay $700 per handset for something that only worked within Kinshasa. Where we start heading over time is probably towards mesh networks based around consumer Wi-Fi. And one of the things that I've been fascinated with in my work in sub-Saharan Africa is discovering that the idea of the wireless ISP, which is really only catching on now in the US and has recently come to Europe, was the dominant form of internet provisioning in Ghana in 2000. And at that point, it was mostly point-to-point microwave, which then got down to about $1,000 a unit. We're now getting down to the point where you can do some of the mesh work down at about $100 a unit. We're not quite there yet. We may not, in fact, get there because the mobile networks we have may be sufficient enough that there isn't an incentive to go further. One of the reasons that mobile did not catch on especially quickly in the US as compared to the developing world was that it was a replacement technology rather than a new functionality. The fact that mobile phones have done so very well actually makes it very, very difficult to justify the investment in that completely peer-to-peer open network. So it's going to be very hard to test my assertion, which is always the nice thing about putting up an assertion with you in the room, Yohai.
Shall I?
Like just follow up on, sorry.
I was just trying to answer the question. Please. One thing I will certainly do is to join the Berkman Center so to learn how to speak fast English. Let me say that in answer to your question, earlier on we were talking about the nature of these meetings. In the past, I attended meetings myself when they were technology-centric. Whenever we come to talk about technology, it's only... At the time, it was only the problem with technology. What are the solutions? What's the hardware? What's the software? Do we have the capacity for it? Now, this has been totally ironed out. People don't talk about technology. They say technology is the medium, right? It's the tool. And that whatever you want to do, there is the technology for it. And here, I wish to draw you to the human aspect. Now, the fact that our meetings are becoming more human-centric, that we talk about the implications of the deployment of technology, whether it's affecting poverty or not, whether women are included in the information age as widely as we want them to be. Questions like this are now becoming more the center of attention. But with that comes the added misery, the fact that I sit at home chatting to my wife over email when I don't have the time to sit with her and talk face to face. And this shows, not that I have anything against my wife, I still love her, but the fact that, the human values are being eroded, and we will have to be careful with this. I say that we are getting physically and technologically more connected, but we're becoming less emotionally and humanly connected and communicating in a way that we have to watch our human values as we go along the technology track. And with that comes the very expensive question, where do you draw the line? I think technology is moving regardless. It's not stopping because I dislike it. It's not stopping because my grandmother does dislike it. It is moving fast, and we will have to discipline it in a way that it suits our needs and aspirations. And here I would like to end with a joke, if you allow me. That takes extra 10 minutes of the time. That there was three famous dictators in the Arab world bragging about their love of technology. So one of them just pointed his two fingers and put them next to his ear and lips. And the other dictator says to him, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm receiving a call." And then he looks at the second one and he said to him, he's blinking. And he goes, "Why are you blinking?" He said, "Oh, I'm receiving a video." And then comes our friend Arafat, who had shaking lips. I still respect the man. Then they said to him, "What's wrong with you?" He said, "Oh, I'm receiving a fax." So just to show, you know, how I was asked on radio on a live interview 2 weeks ago as to where I think mobile telephony would stop. And it just came to mind that we no longer need a handset to put next to our ears. And remember this, we will have a chip embedded next to our ear, and you just have the name of the person, say Sabri, and then it dials a number that clicks in your ear, and then you hear my voice, and then we get talking. But the mere fact that we look at people in cars now speaking on wireless speakers, and we, 2 years ago, we used to say these are mad people talking to themselves. Now, with the information age, it looks like we will become outdated one day. Thanks.
Okay, I'm trying to, I hope I got your question right, but with regret, I mean, if it was, is this an ICT issue or is this an otherwise issue that excludes women? I think I would have to say it's not an ICT issue, it's a lot of the other. Because 6 years ago, we had Mohammed Yunus here from the Grameen Bank, and he described in some detail about how shocked everyone was at the thought that they would give mobile phones to illiterate women. And that how could these literate women do this? He said, you know, in one night they were blindfolded and by the morning they could do any telephone number, you know, that was given to them. So where there's a will, there's a way. I also have some very amusing personal stories of senior Asian women who were married to equally, if not much more senior Asian men, who found themselves at night teaching their husbands because they had, of course, learned how to type. What it was called typing, and now, of course, word processing. Their husbands, because they were the males, didn't learn any of that. And on the weekend, we had a very interesting example of one of these people known to lots around the table whose wife was teaching him how to Skype. So I don't think it's an ICT issue. I think it's much more an exclusion, lack of power, governance issue that leads to low levels of access, education, poverty, and things like that. I wish I could say it was an ICT, but I don't think I could.
Question for the discussion. Listening to the discussion, a lot of most speakers talked about how we are going to do something. And I would like to ask who the we is, because I suspect that the we is different, different people in different circumstances. In the academic community, the we is usually a philosopher king who somehow is guiding the overall course of development. And if we acknowledge that there is no philosopher king guiding the overall course of development, then who are we talking about every time we use we, when we must do this and we must do that? The second aspect is, after the complete denial of technological determinism, the discussion had an awful lot of technological determinism in it. And so I'd like to have people answer your questions again and tell us who we are and not say anything about technological determinism.
Well, in this case, when a new concept or or concept that has been around, but it's actually put up for testing and for discourse. I think the we includes everybody who is part of that process. And I think the subtext of this forum is very much about openness. You also talked about it in your paper. And I think with that comes the responsibility of thinking it through and realizing the shadow side. Because concepts are a totally powerful force, especially because so many levels of it become unconscious. I mean, for the sake of God, people have been killed. For the sake of democracy, people are still being killed all over the world. And they and when you would ask an average American citizen, they would believe in the democracy of their country. And they would think it's a worthy export product. Maybe it's only in America where they still think that American democracy is a worthy export product, but the concept has settled and it is not questioned. And we are now at the birth of a new concept, and I think the we includes all of us. And the point I wanted to make is that we shouldn't underestimate the responsibility we have right here, because at a certain stage, a concept takes hold, and then it becomes so powerful because all those other layers become unconscious, like liberalism, like democracy. And openness can also become abused if it is not realized in what context it takes place. For me, openness is potentially very dangerous because it doesn't have a normative stance. And in this world of us, which is so deeply unjust, it's what we have created. So there are dynamics at play, which we, with all the good intention in the world around this table, are not able to turn around. We cannot influence. But what we can do is not deny that they are there, and that whatever concept we put into that very volatile power field will start playing a role in that power field. And the more we are unaware of that or try to keep openness out of that, the more the unintended effects will be there. Like to have a gender-blind access policy at the University of Harare resulted in gender discrimination, because this gender-free, gender-blind access rule was played out in a gendered field, a gender-imbalanced power field. And we are now knowing that whatever we do is taking place in a totally power-imbalanced world. So no concept can be free of that. And with all the goodwill in the world, we cannot take off our hands off and wash our hands in innocence when things are going wrong in the future. Point?
Hernan, you've been waiting patiently for a while.
I think, in a way, Bill has already addressed my question, but simply to maybe reframe it a different way. And I found all those examples that relate to political activism very powerful, Ethan and gentleman from Palestinian and all Russia, everybody I think mentions a very powerful example. But my question is, as Bill was saying, is the problem really, I mean, the problem is really an institutional failure rather than a technological problem. So, I agree that technology might help improve the and fill certain gaps, but the basics of political corruption, lack of accountability, failed party systems, and so on, will still be there. So I'm really posing this as a question. Is should we really assume that this is always going to be the case, so we need to engineer technological systems to mitigate failure of institutions? But the real problem, are we really addressing the real problem, which is failed institutions that are not representative, that are corrupt, that et cetera, et cetera?
It was a technology determinism question too. It's about the inherent qualities of mobile networks that enable them to be shut down. Now, of course, there's my favorite country, Myanmar, where the internet doesn't exist, so there's no problem about shutting it down. I wonder why Ethiopia is always chosen as an example. I think Lauren and Matt had also used it in their paper. It's one of the countries with the lowest mobile penetration in the world, and it's a state monopoly as far as Google tells me at this moment. They did try to introduce one competitor, but they backed off a couple of years ago. So these are, this is at this level of penetration. Yes, there have been many instances of networks being shut down. Nepal went much better. King Gyanendra shut it down for weeks or months, not for a few days, and see where it got him. Now, the more interesting question is, what is the inherent quality of the mobile network, the same technology in Iran, that didn't allow it to be shut down? I think that's a more interesting question to ask, that when we take any technology, any network, there are affordances and constraints. And this is a continuum. The internet grew up on a pre-existing, centralized, highly controlled, tied to the Department of Defense network. And it was an overlay network. Now, theoretically, you could shut down the U.S. phone system, but the costs are too high. And our argument in looking at this question is that there's a threshold point. And clearly, Ethiopia is not at the threshold point. According to the information that I have, let's put it that way. It's according to the ITU information, it's among the five lowest mobile penetration countries in the world, right? Next to my Myanmar, it's somewhere there, Cuba and Ethiopia. So they can shut this thing down. There's nothing inherent about it. Why they can't shut down the system in Pakistan used to shut it down routinely. Bangladesh used to shut it down every time there was an election, right? But they don't do that anymore, right? So there's nothing inherent about this. The more interesting question is there's a threshold point beyond which it's too costly to shut it down. And then, of course, the mobile platform, like the old fixed platform that AT&T controlled in the United States, and it had overlay systems on it, and Twitter is a kind of an overlay. So you don't have to shut down, you can't shut down Twitter without shutting down the underlying system. And theoretically, you can shut down the internet. Yes, it can be done. And I know one country where you can shut down the internet anytime you want, because they're channeling all the connectivity through a common access point, through internet exchange, Bangladesh, right? There's nothing inherent about this. I think it's a much more profitable thing, even to go back to your opposition to technological determinism and to actually ask the questions, the interesting questions of under what conditions does mobile allow it to be used in certain ways? Under what conditions does it not allow it to be used in certain other ways? Thank you.
I think you may be blurring a couple of aspects of what I was trying to discuss. My thought is not that this notion of generativity is necessarily based on whether you can keep something up or shut it down. It's certainly true that we know that there are numerous choke points on aspects of the internet in the same way that there are choke points on mobile phone networks. Where generativity comes into play largely has to do with the ability to create new uses of these networks and make those uses available to any number of other people. When we talk about Twitter being an overlay on the internet, the key aspect of this is the idea that no one needed to ask for permission to institute a new protocol, a new application, a new tool, and to make it available to anyone who had access to that network. And that's very, very different from how mobile phone networks work. So you're certainly right. You're also right that the interesting question in all of this is the Iran question. It's one that we've actually been studying very closely at the Berkman Center. One of the things that's interesting about this is that edge cases, countries that have very, very low penetration, seem to feel that they can disconnect without much social harm. And one way to think about this is that if Myanmar decides that it's going to cut off its 375,000 mobile phone subscribers to the world, it doesn't send a novel message that Burma is particularly repressive. We already know that Burma is particularly repressive. It's actually a fairly different message when Iran tries to do that. And what we saw in Iran was sort of fascinating. The mobile phone network continued to be an extremely effective way to get news out during the protests. And beyond that, we saw the internet shut down, but only for about 2 hours. And then we saw it come back online heavily filtered and heavily constrained at about a sixth of the capacity that it was at before, and essentially shutting down the ability to get streaming video. So I think this notion that at a certain point technologies become inevitable and therefore much harder to control, they become so embodied within the social fabric that the consequences, both politically in terms of the message you're sending and commercially in terms of how Iran can continue to be involved with the different businesses and interactions that it is, becomes very, very important. But I do think that the distinction that I'm trying to offer between the ability to create novel uses and the ability to have networks that are centrally controlled continues to be a valid one, independent of the question of how you can shut down or not shut down.
I'll respond to that in my talk.
One of the apparent consequences of the discussion is that there's a discomfort zone in which many of us find ourselves, and the discomfort zone is grappling with the, I think, the scope and the scale of the plethora of issues that come out of this kind of a discussion, and that was one of the original aspects of the open internet. That was termed to be disruptive, and I think it applies today as much as it did 15 years ago when it was first used to describe the types of technologies that we're discussing here. They are disruptive, and they do cause discomfort. And I'll illustrate this with a story I've told before, so stop me if I've bored you with this over a beer. At an institution where I used to work at, we had a large enterprise resource planning system in place. This was a major investment on the part of the institution, and they had invested a great deal of money into both the human and the financial side of implementing this massive system, which about 2.5 years after implementation and about $25 million was bought out by another company. And the fear that ran up the spines of our administrative branch of the institution was palpable. You could see the fear and the sweat and the nervous twitches appear that this entire investment that they had made in this system was going to go down the tubes. So in order to address the concerns of the employees who were very upset and nervous and concerned about this, they invited the chief executive officer of the company that had just made the purchase to come to our institution and address it and to try to calm the fears. The world's chief technology determinist came to our campus, Larry Ellison, who's a profoundly unhappy man, as you all know, because he's not as rich as Bill Gates, came to the institution and gave us a talk, which almost caused a riot, because he stood up in front of a very nervous group of people and said, our new technology that will be incorporated into your ERP will not only show you how to do your job better, it will actually show you what jobs to do. And the crowd became militant. And didn't storm the stage exactly, but the virtual slings and arrows were very obvious. And I can tell you, having lived through that not long afterwards, within 2 years of him making that pronouncement, he was absolutely right. There were complete overhauls of the skills and capacity within the administrative side of the university and the academic side, I will admit, as well. People's job descriptions changed. People were let go. New people were hired. There was a complete transformation that occurred within the institution as a consequence of implementing software. This is unavoidable. It causes discomfort, and change is an inevitable part of this whole picture. And I think the capacity to deal with change, perhaps at an accelerated rate, more than we have had to deal with in the past, is a large part of our discomfort and the disruption that we think is happening. At the end of the day, it turned out to be the right thing to do. And I just want to point that out because, Clotilde, you talked about the change within the educational system and the discomfort that all participants in the teaching and learning enterprise are undergoing. And it's true within the healthcare system as well. It's true in government. It's true in the publishing industry. We're dealing with discomfort and having to compensate somehow for that level of discomfort. And it's interesting to see the levels and the rate of adoption of what we would consider to be disruptive, discomforting technologies, the rates of adoption being much higher and more acceptable in environments where the legacy isn't a constraint. Thank you.
Okay, the question that was posed was, what are the skills that we would need to invest in? And I think that it's really not only about skills and competencies, but also, as you said, about general capacities. And in this respect, I think that we have clearly identified what the skills for the 21st century are, and there's a lot of literature on this topic. For example, invention and imagination, problem solving, creativity, decision making, entrepreneurship, ability to communicate, and high productivity. And there are many, many analyses of what the list of potential skills could be. The great difficulty is not identifying the skills, but finding the ways to generate those in certain learning contexts, particularly in what we know today as the ecologies of learning, that you learn in school, out of school, in work, in the community, that learning is a continuous process that you're constantly generating independent of whether this is formal or non-formal. And what I would like to add is that very much as Ineke said, concepts and visions are very important in this respect. And, for example, at ODF, the Omar Dengo Foundation in Costa Rica, where I've been working for 20 years in this field, we have specifically developed learning environments and proposals to address these issues. For example, the decision to start working with kids from preschool on, learning different computer programming skills, not to turn kids into mechanical programmers, but to allow them to address creative problem solving, the capacity to generate their own products, to be active members, active participants of the digital age, I think has shown to have an impact even in the development of a software industry in Costa Rica. For example, we worked with citizenship issues and used technology to promote citizenship and learning about community involvement, generated a referendum online to allow kids to debate, to deliberate, to be able to decide. We've always worked also in the area of entrepreneurship, generating virtual learning environments with simulations in which kids can run their own companies, their own enterprises, and learn about how this happens in the new world, in the context of the new demands. I think that there are many innovative approaches that you can lead to develop these skills. But I think that this is an area where specific investment and research needs to be conducted. So research and development of new methodologies, new approaches, sharing of how education systems, both formal and non-formal, can really address the big challenge, because we keep having in the education community, particularly at universities, great resistance to use technology in innovative ways. And I think that this is one of the major challenges to bring about transformation for the new economy and transformation for knowledge-based societies, which are something we really have to devote a lot of time and thinking to, because it has to do, as Amartya Sen said 6 years ago, and I think he suggested it today, we need, in a skills-intensive society, we need to invest in the young, we need to invest in education, but in new forms of education, not more of the same.